This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
If we are attacked by nuclear weapons, these are the warning sounds you must recognize. First, the attack warning. If an attack is expected, the sirens will sound a rising and falling note like this.
Welcome to episode 11 of Cold War Conversations. That chilling piece of audio you've just heard was from a public information film that was to be broadcast to the British public should nuclear war have been imminent. Today, we're covering the Royal Observer Corps, a British civil defence unit that would have been in the front line of monitoring a nuclear attack on the UK. We're talking to Alastair McCann, who has preserved an underground Royal Observer Corps monitoring post as a museum in Northern Ireland. We talk about the museum, the difficulties of the Northern Ireland Royal Observer Corps during the Troubles, and what the reality would have been for these men and women should the Cold War have turned hot. I hope you find our conversation as interesting as I did. We welcome Alastair McCann. Hi, Alastair. How are you?
I'm very well, Ian. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, no, thank you very much for coming on Cold War Conversations. I really appreciate it, and I'm quite intrigued to hear about your project. So could you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Certainly, yes. Well, I mean, it's quite an honour to be on the show, because obviously I have been quite a long time listener, and some of the guests you've had on before have you know, very varied academic backgrounds. I mean, I come into this I'm a builder by trade, family man, have no sort of academic background in history or anything like that there. I do this because of the love of it.
Alastair, you're particularly interested in the Cold War and the role of the Royal Observer Corps. Can you just give a little bit of background as to who the Royal Observer Corps were and what they did?
Yes. Well, my personal interest stems from the fact that my grandfather served in the Second World War in Edinburgh with the Observer Corps, as they were known then. He was at veterinary training college, and he had heard about this organization. One of his friends had joined this organization in his spare time, and he said, literally, you're in the middle of a field looking for enemy aircraft. And up until that point, there had been no enemy aircraft. So my grandfather signed up for this organization, had some rudimentary training, and found himself one night in a field and watched the very first Nazi bombing raid of the 1st of 4th. So he wrote about this in a memoir, very rough draft of a memoir that I found maybe 5 or 6 years after he passed away. Mm-hmm. And I saw this reference to the Royal Observer Corps, and that led me on to discovering that this organization had 1,500 monitoring posts situated all over the United Kingdom, primarily set up to spot enemy aircraft, and then later on in the Cold War to basically watch for incoming ICBMs dropping and coming in and exploding in the United Kingdom, and to report the resulting explosions and the radioactive fallout.
And as a result of your interest, I understand that you've decided to preserve one of these posts.
Yes, that happened. It was a sort of a very fluid thing. I mean, I had taken it upon myself to visit every single one of the remaining posts in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. Being a builder, I do find myself in certain parts of the country. And with it's quite good now with Google Maps. You can get little overlays that show you where certain points of interest are. And somebody had gone to the trouble of doing an ROC one. So I was able to, on my travels, just have a little point of interest every now and again would pop up in my sat nav. I would visit one of the posts, photograph it, see what condition it was in. And I just so happened to discover one about 10 minutes drive away from my house. It was in relatively good condition, and the farmer was quite accommodating, and of a peppercorn rent of £1 a year, he let me restore it.
Wow. That's a good deal you got there, Alistair. I'm impressed.
Yes, and being a typical farmer, I'm paid up for 20 years in advance because I only had a £20 note, and he said he didn't have any change. So I'm there for 20 years if I like it or not.
Brilliant. And sorry, just going back to the Royal Observer Corps, I mean, you mentioned your grandfather sort of heard about the organisation and was recruited. I mean, how did recruitment work? Was it generally word of mouth, or were they advertising, or what were they doing to get people on board?
Essentially, it was just people in the local pub, you know, with just the local constabulary would sort of go around people that they knew were trustworthy, they knew, you know, wouldn't call, raise an alarm just for a joke. And around a lot of universities and colleges, that's where they got a lot of the recruits from at the time, just young men, right, who a lot of spare time. And my grandfather, being too young to join the Army or the Air Force or the Navy, just joining university, was just a perfect age with a lot of spare time that he could do this job.
Okay. So the Royal Observer Corps monitoring posts, if we can just sort of describe what they're like, because they're not a big installation, are they?
As bombs started to get bigger, they realized that, you know, we're going to have to do something not to keep our observers safe, but more to keep the information flow going. So we're going to have to do something, get these guys underground, get them safe, get as much information flowing for as long as humanly possible before, you know, the eventual outcome happens with fallout. So they, from about 1958, they started to excavate these monitoring posts, which are about, let me see, above ground, we're talking 15 to 20 feet by about 10 feet. In size. It's about 15 feet below ground at its lowest point. Entry is via ladder, and below ground you have two rooms. One would be a sort of toilet storage room, which would be about 3 feet by 3 feet, and then you have a sleeping and working room, which would be about 10 feet by 8 feet.
Right.
So very, 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 very basic, and only enough room down there for three people.
Right. Okay. And so the access is via a hatch in the ground and down a ladder. And then when you first climbed into one of these bunkers, what was your first, you know, what was your first impression like?
There's so many photographs of posts online, and the one thing people will say about them is they all look the same. The weird thing about every post I've ever been in, there's always differences, a little subtle differences that observers have done themselves to try to make it slightly more homely. You know, there's posts I've been in, I mean, other than the posts in Northern Ireland, I've been in posts in England, Wales and Scotland as well. And I've been in posts where one of the observers was an artist. So he's actually painted windows on the walls with landscapes and things like that there. Wow. Just to try to make it a little bit more homely. They've put curtains up in front of the bunk bed so that, you know, observers get a little bit of privacy. They've tried to make ventilation slightly better by putting in, you know, electric fans and things like that there. I know a friend of mine, David Shaw, he was in Carlisle group, and they had access to 240 volt electricity, and they actually had a microwave and a TV in their post. So it's just little things like that there. It's every time I go into a post, the first thing you get is the smell. All the posts smell the same, the slightly damp, musty smell of unused. You know, the first time I was in one was about 2007. So the posts had been closed, you know, from 1991. So on some occasions, I was the first person into them since that period. And the farmer was giving me the keys and let me unlock these padlocks and get down into them. And slightly damp. Some posts did suffer from damp. So sometimes you did get a little bit of standing water. But on some occasions, I would be going into a time capsule. You know, literally the post was exactly how it was left in 1991.
Wow.
Still bits of paperwork on the desk. A lot of the original BT equipment. BT simply left it in the post. They didn't see any point. BT would install the early warning equipment and some of the communications equipment. They just didn't bother collecting it. In some posts in Northern Ireland, there were on the side of mountains and things like that there, you'd have to walk for about half a mile across a couple of fields to get to it. BT just, you know, what are we going to do with this stuff? We'll just leave it here because there really isn't any other use for it. So I was going into this post and all this equipment was still on the wall. Now, none of it worked, but, you know, it was still there and it was still all connected up to a telephone pole.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. And the bunker that you run as your museum, what condition was that in when you first went in?
Dirty, but only through people visiting it. At the time, there was no sort of direct access to it, so people would have to put on a pair of boots and walk across a field to it. Right. So it was a bit muddy and dirty on the floor, but nothing that, you know, 3 or 4 weekends worth of work didn't sort out. What I did was I sort of, the hatch was very, very rusty, so I sort of had to attack that with an angle grinder and get it cleaned up, and the padlock hasps on it were sort of rusted in position, so a blowtorch had to be taken to those to free them up. I managed to get one of the original keys. For security reasons, when you do close the hatch, you don't lock it with padlocks. You sort of lock the padlocks open, if you understand. And you close the hatch, and then there's like an internal locking mechanism. That was just completely missing. Somebody had broken that off.
Right.
So I got a friend of mine to sort of manufacture this brand new locking mechanism, which I refitted. So that made the post secure. I didn't want to start doing anything until I knew the post was secure. And once that was in place, then I could start getting all the electrics rewired down below ground and then start going out and getting all the equipment.
Yeah.
And that probably took the most work. That was the fun part. I loved doing that. I loved doing the work to it. And I would find myself there to maybe 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, painting downstairs below ground. And very odd occasions I would stay the night just to let paint dry and then finish it up in the morning.
I bet you were high on those fumes by the time you came out the next morning, no?
When I did the latter, it was, yeah. I used a two-coat epoxy on that, and that was interesting, I can tell you.
Yeah.
But it was great fun. That was a really good time because I was doing that all myself. At that stage, I sort of had yet to meet any of the former observers. I spoke to a few of them on the phone, but nobody had shown any interest to actually come out and, you know, take part and, you know, do it with me. Because I think they were a bit apprehensive about this guy that really had no association other than his grandfather in the Second World War. I didn't serve in the Royal Observer Corps myself. So they maybe thought, you know, this is just some guy who's not really going to, he's not going to take it anywhere. He's going to do a bit of work, find out it's too difficult, and then give up on it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the hard work was really only beginning there. I didn't realize how difficult it would be then to sort of obtain all the equipment. That was where that's where it got difficult.
Right. So it had been gutted to some degree as far as the equipment was concerned when you got it?
So in July 1991, the Royal Observer Corps were basically notified that they were going to be stood down. And in September 1991, that came to pass, and every monitoring post and all the headquarters all over the United Kingdom, they all stood down. They were all closed. So the Northern Ireland office were tasked by the Home Office to start gutting out all the Northern Ireland posts. So just a team would go round every post in a van and just clear the post of all the sort of nuclear monitoring equipment. Some of the communication equipment, they would remove things like radios, but anything that belonged to BT, that stayed in situ and was up to BT. If they wanted to remove it, they could. Mm. And I mean, they were taking everything. They were taking bunk beds out. They were taking tables, chairs, all the food supplies, everything. And depending where that post was situated, they would remove less. Things like bunk beds are very, very difficult to sort of get up out of the shaft. They're sort of, they're built almost exactly the width of the shaft. The shaft's 2 feet by 2 feet. So there's not much room to get a bunk bed up out of there. You would find that they would leave those. If the post was at the top of a hill somewhere in the middle of a field, the bunk beds would stay. Mm-hmm. But everything else was taken. So when I was going around these posts, you would see to varying degrees, different bits of equipment they would leave. Some training equipment they would leave behind. Maybe something had fallen behind a cupboard. You would pull the cupboard out and you'd find some piece of equipment had dropped down behind it. So I'd got little tiny bits, and with farmers' permission, I would either buy it off them or they would just give it to me. So I was getting little bits and pieces, paperwork especially. That was a big deal for me, getting original paperwork, because generally when stuff comes up for sale on eBay, it's always England or Wales or Scotland. It's Northern Ireland was very, very specific. So getting stuff which actually had 31 group on it, which was Northern Ireland's group, was very, very special to me. And then the equipment, that was sort of contacting museums. eBay proved very, very, very special there for getting bits of equipment.
I'm interested to know, I mean, the farmers or the people whose land the posts were on, was this piece of land compulsorily purchased by the government, or how was that agreement with the landowner done with the government? Do you know?
Yes, well, during the Second World War, obviously, they would just set up in a farmer's field somewhere. Generally, it was the farmer that was actually, he was one of the members of the post with them. As the Second World War progressed, they started to put up more permanent structures. And then the landowner started to get paid a rent after that. Then as the Cold War began and they started to do the underground posts, they tended to site them where the Second World War above ground post was to try to get round going to the farmer and sort of having to buy the land off them. So this sort of rent would continue, and it was usually a 10-year lease, and you got about £100 a year. And then when it became to doing the underground posts in sort of Northern Ireland, we didn't have the Observer Corps here during the Second World War. Recruitment only began in Northern Ireland in 1954. Right. So a compulsory purchase order had to be made then. And in a lot of the sites, the farmers, sort of said, listen, we'll take you to court and different things. It got quite nasty in certain situations. So again, they were started to go and try to do a rental agreement with some farmers, and in some cases, where rent and sort of thing, England would be £100, rent for a post over here would be about £200. So the farmers, did see sort of this little, they stuck their arm in a wee bit and got a little bit of extra money out of the government for doing it.
Yeah. I mean, is that because, I don't know, I was going to ask you this about recruitment in Northern Ireland, because I was interested to know whether there was a sectarian angle there in terms of who was accepted into recruitment of the Royal Observer Corps.
They tended, in 1954, when recruitment began, a lot of the first members that joined were ex-RAF from the Second World War, just because they had the aircraft background.
Yeah.
As that progressed, they started to recruit from towns and villages. Obviously, the posts are going to be situated a couple of miles, maybe a mile outside of town or village. So they wanted to have people that were close to the post that could get there quickly. So that the sectarian divide, which really was only starting to begin in the 50s over here. Obviously there was small sporadic violence here in the 50s. But nothing major had started to begun until the end of the 60s, start of the 70s. But no, they recruited from both sides of the community then. I'm very lucky that I do have a lot of ex-observers as friends now. And I can phone them up for asking bits of advice. And no, they had no policy of recruiting from one side of the community. But it was probably a lot easier before the Troubles. I would imagine that there was a lot more a wider spectrum from both communities. I'd say before the troubles started, I would say that after the troubles began, that the nationalist community, I would say quite a few members left, or just in case they were seen to be, you know, colluding with the enemy, sort of, so to speak.
Yeah, because I was, and like, I guess the other thing is, if you've got a, you know, you're a farmer who is a nationalist, and you've got a Royal Observer Corps post on your land.
Yes, well, I mean...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
It wasn't until the early 70s where a security mandate had to be written out that observers couldn't wear uniforms. That was the first thing. If you're reporting for duty, don't wear uniforms, just come in your own clothes.
Right.
Then it was the posts are going to have to close for a certain amount of time because of the deteriorating security situation. That amount of time went from being a year to being 2 years to being 3 years, and eventually it was actually 10 years the posts had to close for because of the security situation. So wow. From 1971 until 1981, all the posts were closed. You would check on them, you would go and check on them, and you would have to notify the police that you were going up to check on the post, and the police would go out with you, and you would look, make sure the post was still in one piece, and then that was it, you would leave. You would do all your you would do all your training in local territorial army camp or in the local police station, but the posts were completely closed. There was no nuclear monitoring other than the group headquarters. There was no community-based nuclear monitoring taking place at all in Northern Ireland for a period of 10 years.
Wow.
You know, which was very detrimental. You know, that's a very large portion of the United Kingdom just completely wiped out. And a couple of posts were attacked in that situation. We had a couple of posts were firebombed. In fact, where I grew up, I live in a town called Lurgan, which is in Armagh, which during the Troubles was a very, very, very focal point of the Troubles. Any of your listeners who are ex-Army will know Armagh very, very well and probably know Lurgan very, very well. And the post that was actually behind my house, Lurgan ROC post, was situated in the field in the house I grew up. And in December 1980, it was firebombed. The IRA broke into it, stole all the monitoring equipment out of it, and firebombed it. And because obviously the posts were still closed at that point, it wasn't until 3 months later that a BT engineer, just carrying out a routine inspection, just found this post completely destroyed.
Right.
So the army were called. The army came out and started doing a sweep around the countryside and uncovered an arms cache. And inside this arms cache was some of the warning equipment. And I actually have the army evidence file that actually shows a photograph of all this equipment laid out, with surrounded by hand grenades and shotguns and things like that there.
Wow.
And you know, it's also superb. It's an absolutely superb document. I got it from Q.
Yeah,
and it goes into some detail, like an army helicopter had spotted the air raid siren on the top of a local block of flats, but they advised not going to get it back because of the local, you know, civil population would probably riot. So it, you know, just some of these fantastic documents, just, you know, so local to me. That's just, you know, a fantastic little shot at history there.
Yeah, no, that is fascinating. That's really interesting. And the equipment that was in the bunker, what was in there? I mean, I don't want to go into a huge amount of detail, but obviously there was something to monitor the blast wave, and there was something on the surfaces, I believe, to pinpoint where the nuclear detonation had gone off.
Correct. Yes. I mean, the nuclear detonation, when the explosion went off, there'd be a pressure wave, and that would travel along the ground. And depending how far, obviously, how close you were to the blast, you would have a larger pressure wave. So below ground, you had a piece of equipment called the bomb power indicator, and there was a set of baffle plates. The pressure wave would go down a pipe, down into the bomb power indicator, and a needle on the bomb power indicator would, in PSI, would show you the PSI of the explosion. And by triangulating then your pressure reading with pressure readings from other posts, you could effectively work out what size the explosion was and how far away it was. And then a minute after the explosion went off, one of the observers then had to go above ground, which is just ridiculous when you think about it.
Yeah, so and did they draw straws for that, or how was that person nominated?
I would imagine it was probably the person that was the sort of the least stars or stripes on their uniform. There was a rank structure. There was a chief observer who was sort of in charge of the post. There was a leading observer who was the second in command. He was the training instructor. And then you had a normal observer, either a male observer or a female observer. And I would imagine it was probably one of those the lowly guys and girls that had to go up above ground and do it. It's horrendous when you think about it. You know, it's the fact that the mushroom cloud would still be forming, you know, a minute after the explosion. So, you know, obviously that the fallout wouldn't have reached you by this point, but still have been quite a scary situation to go above ground and to see this mushroom cloud forming, you know, maybe 10, 15 miles away from you. Yeah. And there was a device on the surface, which was a pinhole camera. Very, very, very simple. No electronics involved whatsoever. And it was called a ground zero indicator, or a GZI for short. And you just took the lid off it, and inside was just exposed photographic paper. And that was inside a cassette, a graticule cassette. And that was north, south, east, and west. So by taking that down below ground, you changed them for new ones, put the lid back on, climbed back down the ladder. And again, by triangulating what your the cassettes, what the grid coordinates and that gave you, and then by using the blast pressure, you could work out the size of the explosion, distance of the explosion, what height the explosion was at, and then obviously then how much fallout that bomb would be giving off. Right.
Okay, and you mentioned that device didn't have any electronics. I'm not a great scientist, but I do know that a nuclear weapon releases an electromagnetic pulse, which fries electrical circuits. So how was the equipment inside the bunker protected against that?
It was and it wasn't. Obviously, when the posts were built in 1958, EMP was quite a new thing. And the posts were poured sectional concrete with steel reinforcement. The equipment that was powered below ground was all powered by 12 volt. So your lighting system, lighting circuit was all 12 volt. Your battery system was all charged via 12 volt petroelectric generator. The only thing which was essentially over the mains was your telephone system, which would have been 50 volt powered from the local telephone exchange. The telephone system, I think, would have been the first thing that would have failed. Everything was via overhead telephone cables. So, you know, just little silly things. I mean, by how good the posts were, I mean, they had a protective factor from fallout of 50,000 to 1. So fallout would have to be 50,000 times greater than background radiation to actually penetrate into the post. But still, EMP would have just wiped out the telephone network straight away. So there's your communication system gone.
So that makes pretty pointless then, doesn't it? Because surely the whole point of this is to be able to communicate back to their headquarters.
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's probably the most fallible aspect of all the post system. It's ridiculous when you think about it. I mean, I have spoken to a couple of observers who did raise this during sort of large training camp weekends. They would go off to these RAF bases. It was basically a jolly. They would do a lot of training and a lot of drinking. That's what I've been told. And they essentially were, somebody raised the question, listen, what about this telephone system? I mean, it's all overhead cables. I mean, obviously these telephone poles are going to burst into flames. the whole telephone system's going to be fried straight away. And somebody said, oh, well, BT will come out if East and West communication breaks down and we have troop movements. They'll drop the cables onto the ground. So they'll put them in, they'll put them into a shallow trench and they'll bury them. And somebody saying, well, hold on a second. There's 1,560 posts exactly all over the United Kingdom. Are you trying to tell me that BT will be able to get enough people to come out and do every single one of those posts all over the country in the space of a week? You know, and anybody nowadays has ever tried to get broadband fitted, you know, will know that yeah. there's not a chance that would have happened. So, you know, one in every four posts were sort of organized into clusters of sort of two to four posts. And one post in every four was designated a master post, and that post had a radio. So there was a fallback to have a radio. Now, whether that would have worked after the explosion or not, we will never know. They did radio tests on the post during training exercises, and very, very rarely would the radios actually be able to reach back to group control.
Right.
So... It's one of the things we will never know if the system would have worked. I think the equipment would have worked. I think they would have been able to get the readings. They would have been able to take the measurements. That all would have worked. The communication system, I think that was the most fallible part of the whole thing.
Right. And presumably they were going to have a network of runners or something going from each of these non-radio connected posts to the master post. Well, mind you, they were quite a distance away, weren't they? Because weren't they about 7 or 8 miles from each post or something like that?
Yeah, generally it was about 8 to 10 together. And what they tried to do was the post crew would have been people from the town closest to it. They tried to recruit from the town closest to it. So generally, if tensions have become hot, so the Cuba Missile Crisis, for instance, you have a period where it's starting to build, people are starting to get worried about it, it's on the news more and more, there would have been a system called transition to war. So the group control would have been told that the United Kingdom Warning and Monitoring Organization, which was the group in charge of the Royal Observer Corps, under the umbrella of the Home Office, they would have been told to stand to. And group control would have then let all the chief observers know that you're on transition to war. So the chief observers would then phone their leading observer, and they would then in turn phone all of the other post crew. The leading observer would go to the post to meet the rest of the post crew to give them their rota, and then they would have been put on 12-hour rotating shifts. And then the chief observer, he would go to group control and collect the ration packs and their war equipment, all their battery supplies, things like that there, go back to the post, and then they would continue in a rota shift pattern until the 4-minute warning happened. So the crew that was in the post when the 4-minute warning was sounded, so there was a piece of equipment on the wall installed by BT called a carrier control receiver, and it was just a speaker on the wall, and that would get the attack warning red message. And the attack warning red message was basically broadcast from RAF filing deals. And that was the early warning radar station in the Yorkshire Moors.
That's an audio message. So it's somebody saying attack warning red, and it comes through the speaker.
Yes. Now, what you would have would be RAF filing deals would detect the incoming missile. NORAD would more than likely have detected that as well. RAF filing deals would then turn off the speaking clock. So if you had phoned the speaking clock at that point, you would more than likely have heard that message as well. It would then turn on two sets of keys. It would then broadcast a message. Every major telephone in a police station, they had a piece of equipment called a carrier control point, and that was two red telephones, and they would ring. So this policeman who was leaning back of his feet in his desk with a cup of coffee would be startled by these two red telephones suddenly flashing. He would pick up these two red telephones. He would hear the message attack warning red repeated 3 times. He would turn a key. He would turn on the local air raid siren, first of all. He would then press another button, and he would then be connected to all these little warning speakers, which would be situated in the monitoring posts, maybe the local bank, maybe the local village pub, the local vet, places like that. They, in turn, would have their own air raid sirens, and they would go out and start sounding them. And that would be how then the warning message would be broadcast to both them and the general public.
It just sounds unbelievable.
you know, 4 minutes, if you think about it, when RAF Fylingdales, that was 4 minutes. They knew that bomb was coming and they had 4 minutes. By the time that warning message had been broadcast to the general public, we probably only had about 2 minutes.
Yeah, if that.
Yeah.
That's really chilling, I think, is the phrase I was looking for.
Well, it's things like when you think about watching, you know, everybody will have known, any of your UK listeners anyway, will know about Protect and Survive, the book Protect and Survive, and the sort of the government films that came after that. And people are thinking, God, this just looks so basic. And it was really basic. You know, we had no provision in the United Kingdom for public shelters. There was no public shelters at all. While America was building public shelters under most civic buildings in the United States, we had nothing. It was all government and local government based level.
Well, what's the longest time you've spent in the bunker?
I did a weekend long event for the 20th anniversary of the stand down of the Royal Observer Corps. I decided to stay for the weekend along with a group of other people who had also restored posts. We're very, very lucky that one of the guys in Scotland who's restored his post is a bit of an electronics genius. And he worked out that with a little bit of basic rewiring of the post communication system, he could actually get it working again. So all it involved is sort of finding where BT had sort of cut the original telephone wires, doing a bit of resplicing, connecting it to a 3G modem, and you could actually turn the original communication system into a Skype terminal. So by connecting all our modems to the same sort of server, we were all able to talk to each other. In a part, we have sort of reconnected a very small part of the Royal Observer Corps network, which is quite fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. I really like that. I mean, you mentioned that you weren't in the Royal Observer Corps, but I'm just interested to know your thoughts on what you'd do if you had been in the Royal Observer Corps for real and the alarm had sounded.
I was born in 1979, so I was a child, obviously, of the 80s. Yeah. It wasn't until, I vividly remember the Berlin Wall coming down and watching it on television with my parents. I vividly remember that. It's not until I started doing the research into the posts. I mean, I wanted to get it right. I didn't want to do something that it was a museum, but it was very, very basic. I wanted to do something that was proper, that was as authentic as humanly possible. Mm. And when I started to do the research about it, the main concern of all of the ROC hierarchy was how many observers would actually turn up. When they got that phone call to say, a bomb is on its way, or, you know, Russia has started massing troops on the border, would they have been able to pick up their bag from the front door, say goodbye to their wife and their kids, walk out that front door and drive to the post and not for one second think that's probably the last time I'll ever see them?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly the image that I conjure up and sort of, I don't know. And particularly when you talk about, well, it's pretty pointless anyway, because the phone system won't work after the bomb drops.
It's the fact that you had no communication. We're very lucky, very, very lucky. I say to my kids all the time how lucky you are that you can play on your Xbox or PlayStation with one of your friends in Australia and have direct communication with him 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whenever you want. Mm. Back when I was your age, we had none of that. We had no mobile telephones. If you wanted to phone somebody, you had to pick up a rotary dial telephone and, you know, showing my age now and phone somebody with a rotary dial telephone. Things like that, they're just, you know, are so alien to them.
Yeah.
But, you know, even more so back in the 80s, just how basic everything was that you got in your car and you drove away until you saw your family again. Unless you went to a phone box, you know, that was the only time you were going to speak to them, you know. And this story might sound made up, but honestly, it is complete. It's 100% true. Last week, I had a phone call from an ex-observer from the post that is 8 miles. It was in the group, the cluster of posts that my post Portadown down was connected to. Mm-hmm. And he was the ex-chief observer in that post. And he saved everything, all the paperwork, every single bit of paperwork, he saved it. And he got me, he saw I had done an Irish language documentary about underground spaces in Ireland. And he had watched the documentary and seen the post. And he had got my phone number and he'd phoned me and said, listen, I have all this paperwork in my roof space. I would love for you to have it. And I said, listen, that'll be absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for thinking about me. And I drove out to his house and he just mountains and mountains and mountains of paperwork.
Wow.
And I had said to him about the recruitment, you know, obviously you had known what you were, this role you were training for. You were going out to the post, you know, every month or so you were going out to the post and doing these training exercises. Mm. Obviously you were playing war games, but if it had happened for real, you know, how would you have felt? Because obviously, you know, the age of the man he was, and I know the age of his children, his children would have been only maybe 4 or 5 years old at this point. Mm. And he said to me, Alistair, my very, very first day on the job, the chief observer of the post collected me from my house. As I opened the door, my daughter, 4-year-old daughter, ran out and said, bye-bye, Daddy. And he gave her a big, massive hug and he says, I love you. And listen, I'll see you soon. And he gave her a big, massive hug and they all said goodbye and he got into the car and they drove away. And the chief observer turned to him about half a mile down the road. It was completely quiet in the car. And he turned around to him and he said, why did you do that? Do you always do that with your kids? You know, you are going to see them again. And Harry turned around and he said, the job we're doing, if I don't think when I leave this house that I'm never going to see my family again, if I don't prepare myself for that, I will never, ever, when the time comes, leave that front door if I don't prepare myself for the fact that I'll never see my family again. Mm. And the chief observer that was in the car with him then just, the car went completely quiet then for the rest of the journey. 1 week later, and this is completely true, the chief observer resigned his post.
Wow.
Chief observer resigned his post. And that was the first time, this is only a week ago I was told that story.
Yeah.
And that completely hit home to me. You know, I've got three kids, three boys, and I think the training, yes, I could do it, but when the actual time came, I would love to be able to say to you right now that, yes, I would do my duty. I would pick up my bag from the front door and I would head straight to the post. But when that time came, could you, anybody listening to this now, could you honestly say that you would be able to just leave your front door, turn around, see your family, and that could be the last time you'd ever see them?
Yeah, no.
Very.
I don't think anybody could. And it's, you've given a fantastic insight there into the dilemma that all of these people would have had if they'd got the call.
Yeah, this was a voluntary organization. You know, you might have people thinking, oh, well, they were being paid. They were not being paid. This was no different to you joining. I know it sounds so basic, and I'll probably have an ex-observer say, well, that's not what it was like, but it's no different to you being the local scout leader. You know what I mean? It's a voluntary thing that you're going to do on a voluntary basis just to protect your local community.
Yeah.
And it's... You know, okay, if you were getting money for it, maybe it may, I don't think it would make it any easier, but maybe if you were getting a little bit of income out of it, but you weren't getting anything. You were maybe getting a petrol bonus or, you know, a couple of pounds for a tank of petrol, but you weren't getting weren't getting paid for it.
And a uniform you can't wear if you live in Northern Ireland as well.
Yes, a lovely RAF 79 pattern uniform that up until, if you joined in 1970, you weren't able to wear for 10 years. Yeah.
I probably wouldn't fit into it after 10 years, to be honest. But
yeah, well, some observers I know actually kept their uniform. They were so scared of throwing it away. Not so much in case they were recalled to duty, but in case like the local bin man, you know, found it in the bin.
Wow.
And, you know, I had one observer come to one of my very first open days, and he said about 10, 15 years after stand down, he cut his uniform up into little pieces.
Yeah.
And every week or so, he would put an extra bit of the uniform into a bin bag. And so it wasn't all in one bin bag. It was spaced out. And you're thinking, you know, I grew up during the Troubles, you know, but, you know, even that, you know, just think, good grief, you know, that it was that scary. you know, that they have to do little things like that there.
That's a fascinating insight, because it's a whole different angle on the whole Royal Observer Corps story. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because it's particularly interesting in Northern Ireland, because the Cold War, or, you know, some of the hottest bits of the Cold War occurred right in the middle of the Troubles.
You know? Yes.
So
you had a credible threat which could happen at any moment. You also had this specter of threat which was hanging over you from the Soviet Union as well. You'd both sides, you know, really, you had your own community in a certain sense gunning for you, and then you also have this specter of threat then coming from the Soviet Union as well.
Yeah, it's certainly sobering stuff. What I did want to do is ask you a couple of other questions away from the Royal Observer Corps, and it was more about, you know, obviously there's a lot of you know, Cold War and Cold War era films out there. What would be your favorite film of the Cold War, would you say?
That's probably the easiest answer, and I hope nobody's ever said it before, because this is my favorite film. It's probably my favorite Cold War, definitely my favorite Cold War film of all time, if not probably one of my top 10 films of all time, and that'll be The Fourth Protocol.
Okay.
With Michael Caine. Yes, Michael Caine and Pierce Brosnan. Now, it's slightly different from the book, but I think the film is superb, and it has everything in it.
Nobody's chosen that one so far, so well done with that. And if you were going to make a film about the Cold War, what piece of music do you think would make a good soundtrack?
Silent Runnings by Mike and the Mechanics, which is just an eerie song. When you listen to the words of it, it's about a sort of a war which has obviously taken place. And I think it's very, very reminiscent, if you've watched the film, the film based on Protect and Survive? Threads.
Yeah.
Threads. It's sort of based around that. It goes very, very well with Threads. If you watch Threads and then listen to Silent Runnings, it's just basically a sort of a letter left. You could probably say that an observer has left this letter for his wife and family, that to say, you know, just be very, very careful with what happens after the war. And if you listen to the words of the song, they're quite apt.
Right. Okay. That's good. I'll get a link up to that on the show notes. If you could invite three personalities from the Cold War period to have a few drinks with, who would they be?
John F. Kennedy and Khrushchev, just to have both of them sitting and interviewed. Because I honestly think that if John F. Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, I honestly think that somebody would have got to sit down with both of them in the same room discussing the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think that's one of the most fascinating subjects ever, because it's obviously, other than Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's the closest that the world has ever come to all-out nuclear war.
Well, wait for my episode on the Able Archer exercise.
That'll be fascinating, yeah.
It was absolutely critical period of the Cold War, and two fascinating characters. What questions would you be asking them?
What made them both step back? Because up until the point that they did step back, it was almost a certainty. We had all-out panic. You know, any of the documentaries or books that I've watched and read, you know, it was a certainty. People pretty much thought that it was a certainty that it was going to happen. And what made them both just say, listen, you know, we need to step back from this here? Obviously, we had the missiles in Turkey. We had the missiles in Cuba. What made both just say, listen, you know, we need to sit back here and talk about this? Because, you know, John F. Kennedy was a very, very strong person. Khrushchev, you know, was a very, very strong-minded person. It took a lot of courage for both of them to do that. A lot of courage for both of them to do that.
Yeah. Okay. No, very good. Very good choice there. Are there any books or websites you'd recommend for people who would be interested in the Royal Observer Corps during the Cold War? Obviously, I'm going to put a link to your bunker site. Don't worry.
Not a problem. There's two books which I would say would be if you're doing any research at all to involved with the Royal Observer Corps, one would be attack warning red. Now, it's you can't buy it brand new from Amazon or anything like that there, but you can pick up copies from bookshops and eBay. Attack warning red is probably the most essential piece of literature about the Royal Observer Corps, and it pretty much covers their Second World War period and the Cold War period, and it's very, very handy because it also has all the national grid coordinates, GRF coordinates for all of the posts.
Right.
So if you want to visit one, you can more than likely find it listed in the book, and you can go and visit it. The second book would be, it's called The Royal Observer Corps Underground Monitoring Posts. And that came out in 2011. And that basically covers all of their Cold War period. And it goes into detail and such the building of the posts, all of their equipment, how it worked, the observer's role, and then also goes on after that, what happened to the posts after they were closed.
Right. And then I've posts that. Were short. It's quite a big colour sort of coffee table style.
That's the best way to describe it. It is a coffee table book. And I'm I wrote the chapter or helped write the chapter in Northern Ireland in it. So I'm quite proud of it because it's with those two books, you pretty much have, you know, everything you need.
Oh, great. Well, I might be popping over to get an autographed copy then.
Oh, you're more than welcome. You're more than welcome.
I'm not sure my wife would want that on our coffee table. That's the only thing. We mentioned Threads before, which for anybody who hasn't seen it is a UK drama film that was made representing a nuclear attack on Britain in the 1980s.
Yes.
It's quite similar to, I think it's The Day After was an American.
Yes, it's pretty much, yeah, pretty much the same.
So it's pretty similar to that. But are there any other film or TV series, particularly relating to the Royal Observer Corps? Is there anything out there? I know I've seen stuff on YouTube, which is great, and I'll be putting some links up to those because there's some really good representations and some sort of like recruiting films on there, aren't there?
Yeah, if anybody sort of remembers the sort of really old style pre-cinema, if somebody ever went to the cinema and you had the little small sort of documentary almost style film that was shown before your main feature, they're very, very similar to that. It's like recruiting film filmed in the sort of the guise of a little very short dramatization. Some of them are superb. There's a really, really old one, and it's called Sound and Alarm. The Royal Observer Corps' motto was forewarned is forearmed. The United Kingdom Warning and Monitoring Organisation, or UKWMO, which were in charge, they were the sort of the government warning team who were in charge of the Royal Observer Corps. Their motto was sound an alarm, and it was two trumpets. That was their crest. And there was a film, I think it came out in the late 60s, early 70s, called Sound an Alarm. And they had the sort of the group control aspect. They had this local government level bunker aspect, and then they had the warning posts, the monitoring post, and they had a doctor. Somebody had broken their arm, so the doctor had to go out to the control, and the bomb was just about to go off, so the doctor got locked in the control.
Oh, I've seen that one. That is good.
It's so basic, and it just shows everything working so smoothly, and everybody is so calm, and this, you know, this stiff upper lip, a bomb has just come off. We'll just go out for a quick cigarette. You know, so everything was just so by the book. And what happens is in the monitoring post, it's beside the sea, and they have a bomb go off above the sea, which causes a sort of mini tidal wave. So the tidal wave comes in and floods part of the post, and then the blast wave pulls down the telecom wires. So one of the observers just gets his little toolkit and just climbs up the ladder, and he just walks down the road and fixes the telecommunications cable, you know, just like that. And five minutes later, he's back at the post and everything's fine again, you know. And just stuff like that was just, you're watching it now going, they just did not know. They just, either they did know and they weren't telling anybody, or they didn't know, they were just completely clueless about it. And they just thought that if a nuclear attack happened on the UK, it would be four or five bombs, and then we would just go back to work again the next day.
I'm at a loss for words.
Yeah, but it's madness when you watch it. I mean, I would advise anybody who, when they see the link, do click on it and do watch it, because they are, you know, you'll be dumbfounded by just the, you know, how basic they thought everything was going to be. But all of those YouTube documentaries and little film clips, the Royal Observer Corps has actually never been in a feature film or a mainstream television program ever, which I find incredible, actually.
That's a travesty, Alistair. I think that's the only time you see them is in films like The Battle of Britain, in World War II films, where they're there with their thermos and a sandbagged emplacement and their binoculars, observing the Luftwaffe coming in.
There's a little gap in the market there for somebody to do like a, not so much like a soldier, if you remember soldier from the 90s, you know, a little dramatization about, you know, just life in this, this guy is a doctor or a builder in his full-time job, and in his spare time, he's in a nuclear bunker in the middle of a field, you know?
It's almost the perfect film, because you've got basically three people there.
Yes.
You've got a great sort of dramatization. They're all in one room. I mean, you could almost do it as a stage play, to be honest.
Yeah. It lends itself to it so well. And, for the amount of documentaries, I've done three or four documentaries now, with Discovery Channel and Irish Language and the BBC and different things. And I always said to them, well, you know, why is there just no interest in it? And they just said, we just have our budget for certain programs, and that's what we have to do. Yeah.
Maybe it's just you and me, Alistair. We'll be the only people listening to this podcast.
People come to my open days, and I'm sure people get it with you as well, that they just, the Cold War is so recent history, you know, even though the Cold War did end, you know, really in 1992, 1993, but, you know, for certain people, the Cold War has just almost completely been forgotten about, and we're more and more of it is being forgotten about every year that passes, and more of these bunkers, monitoring posts, are being demolished. And we're going to turn around in 20 or 30 years' time and go, why did we not save any of this stuff?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you and me are working against the tide, Alistair. So,
yes, brick by brick.
Absolutely. Are there any museums or locations that would be good to visit around the Royal Observer Corps? Obviously, there's your bunker in Northern Ireland, which is open on various bank holidays, I believe.
Yes, well, I mean, personally, I would open three or four times during the year, and then I would open for a big event, which is called a European Heritage, which is sort of like an open doors event where sites usually wouldn't be open, they open up. So I open up for that, and that's usually fantastic. I would usually get 300 or 400 people come to that, which for a building which is about the same size as your ensuite bathroom can get a little bit crazy. Yeah, just a bit. So we have to run time tours on that. Other than that, there's plenty of museums opened. The RAF Museum have quite a good RAF display, or quite a good ROC display. Hendon and Cosford have both little ROC displays. Okay. We have a lot of local aviation museums, sort of aviation societies have their own little aviation museum. Would tend to have an ROC display that was set up by one of their members who just so happened to be in the Royal Observer Corps, and kept a little bit of equipment back, and then they set up their own display. So there's quite a few of those dotted about the United Kingdom. Probably the most well-known is the English Heritage run former Group Control 20 group in York. That's at Shelley House in Aiken in York, and that's a former Group Control that all the monitoring posts would have been reporting back to that Group Control in that area in the York group. And that's been completely restored to exactly as it would have been in about the 1980s period. And it's a fascinating museum. You know, you are very much going, you know, completely back in time when you enter that. It's exactly as it would have been at the height of the Cold War. And then soon to be opening in Dundee, by a couple of friends of mine. Again, it's another Group Control, but it's the added aspect that it's also a sector control. So it was the Caledonian Scottish sector control. So all of the Group Controls in Scotland would have been reporting back to it. So any nuclear attack on Scotland, all of the information from all the group controls would have been coming back to there. And a group of mine called 28 Group Observed. And they are a charity. It's essentially three or four guys. And they have restored this entire sector control by themselves.
Wow.
And it is just, it's a work of art because everything in it works. You know, it's like, if you go into a museum as a telephone, generally if you pick up the old telephone, nothing happens. In Dundee, if you pick up a telephone, you will get a dial tone. If you press the corresponding telephone extension code, that telephone, the other telephone will ring. Just everything works in it. They have the generator working so they can power the whole bunker of a generator. They have the air filtration system running again. It's a labor of love, and that's the sort of museum that I love. I love a museum that you could go into and you can touch things and you can pick stuff up, because that's how you learn about history, by interacting with it. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do my own post, because, you know, I want kids to be able to come to it and, you know, put on a gas mask.
Well, that's where we had to end our chat with Alastair. There's a ton of extra information in the show notes, including videos, local museums you can visit, including Alastair's, of course, as well as other subjects, books and films we discussed. The show notes can be found at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 11. Don't forget, you can join our discussion group on Facebook. Just search Cold War Conversations. And we're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. If you like what you're hearing, please leave reviews on iTunes or with your podcast provider. Thank you very much for listening. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.